Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air with Cher Huber on KZSU Stanford. I'm your host, Michael Gray. It's great to be here.
As always.
Yes, yes. We have two additional special guests with us tonight, who I'll be introducing in just a moment. If you'd like to contact us when we're off the air, you can send us an email to openair@kzsu.org. Archives of all the shows are available at livingcompassion.org. So feel free to check those out if for some reason this time does not work for you. Cher, you have a busy calendar coming up.
Yes.
Yes.
And
well, that's pretty much generally true.
Yeah, I was going to say I have a busy calendar that I'm just in the middle of. I've been explaining to people that I'm not the brightest star on the horizon today. You know, as if I am other days. a lot of sleep deprivation with travel and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm glad we have these fascinating guests.
Yes.
Because we can get them to be bright. And
yes.
And I can kind of hang back. And you'll be...
I'll be in bright, no doubt.
Big part of the brightness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
So tomorrow night, you'll be at Unity Church in Palo Alto for a Peace Day ceremony.
Yeah.
That's on Middlefield. And it starts at 6:30 p.m., I believe.
Okay. So are there daytime activities and then the evening, or is it mostly an evening schedule?
I think it starts with the evening program tomorrow night, and then I think there's a 24-hour prayer vigil or something
wonderful.
Like that.
Wonderful.
And there's information, I believe, on your website, cherryhuber.com. There's a dinner that's open to the community, I believe, at 5:30 p.m., and then the service starts at 6:30 p.m.
Lovely.
Wonderful. And then on September 17th, you'll be up in San Rafael at the Open Secret Bookstore. That's a Friday night for an evening talk at 7:30 p.m. And then down to Esalen, beautiful Esalen in the southern Big Sur coast, October 3rd to 8th, for a workshop, Zen and Yoga workshop with Krista Rippens, Working with Strong Emotion.
Yes.
Yes.
Body, mind, spirit, emotion.
Body, mind, spirit, emotion. Mm-hmm. Great. And then coming up on October 23rd and 24th, we have a big weekend.
We do. A very big weekend.
A very big weekend.
We're hoping everyone in the world is going to come to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what we're going to do with them when we get them there, but we're definitely hoping that they'll come.
Yes. Saturday, October 23rd, come to Fort Mason in downtown San Francisco. It's beautiful, right on the water. Herbst Pavilion. For a day of meditation and prayer for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have lots of wonderful speakers.
Lots of speakers and lots of activities. All the speakers actually will be not just talking about peace, but leading us in in various activities, prayers, meditations, that sort of thing for peace. And then we have some other kinds of things, like the drumming and the African movement and the St. Francis
Threshold Choir,
and lots of fun and exciting things. We have a labyrinth there.
Oh, yes.
It's very nice.
This is free and open to the public. We ask you to register ahead of time so we know how many lunches to make.
That's right. That's the primary reason. Just if people want to eat, then they need to let us know, and then we'll fix them something.
Vegetarian lunch at minimal cost.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So go to livingcompassion.org to find out all the information about that. Sign up there. And that's all day Saturday, 10 to 5. And then in the evening, we have a wonderful...
Yeah, an opportunity for to participate in, let's face it, fundraising. a gala event with lovely, all kinds of loveliness, music, and it's not a dinner, but hors d'oeuvres and snacks and that sort of thing, and a special dessert, and lots of fabulous, fabulous things for a silent auction.
Yes, yes, that'll be exciting. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, Sunday, October 24th, is our third annual Golden Gate Bridge Walk to support the African Vulnerable Children Project. We'll be hearing a little bit more about that later in the show today, so that's great. And that starts, I believe, at 12 noon on Sunday, and I'm sure it'll be a beautiful day, just like last year.
Oh. Every year.
Every year it's been
great. It's been spectacular. Every year people say, wow, this is the most beautiful day of the year. This is amazing.
Uh-huh. And to be on the water and sunshine.
With fabulous people for a good cause.
Yes, yes. I think that's about it as far as the immediate calendar the next month or two.
You know, actually, there is another thing that I'd like to throw in.
And tell me.
I unfortunately can't remember the exact dates, but it's Bellingham, Washington.
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding
me. Doing a little Friday evening, Saturday workshop up there. It's funny, on our website it says that I'm going to be in Seattle on that Thursday night before that. And my office just contacted the Borders Bookstore in Seattle, where the event was going to be, and they knew nothing about it. The coordinator quit without passing that information along. So I have this fantasy that all kinds of people that I haven't seen in years are going to show up at Borders on Thursday night, ready for this event. And I won't be there, unfortunately.
But, I see. So that event is no
it
more.
It is not going to happen. But that Friday night and then the Saturday in Bellingham.
Beautiful Bellingham, Washington.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that.
When You're Falling Dive.
Correct.
Which is the title of your most recent book. And then an all-day workshop on the same topic the next day?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
As close to the topic as we ever get. See what happens.
Yes. What is the topic anyway?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Be present.
Be present.
Mm-hmm.
How that happens and how it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. That's great. Gives me great pleasure to introduce two special guests today. I'd like to introduce Jen, who's the African Vulnerable Children Project Coordinator for Living Compassion. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you. Really glad to be here.
Good. It's great to have you on the air here.
I was actually dying for you to introduce me so I could jump in on the event.
You know, I was...
Yeah. I didn't want to talk before you'd introduce me because it would seem really weird. Who is this person? But very, very exciting. All the October events are going to be spectacular.
Tell us more about the Bridgewalk, because I know you've been
working on that.
Yes, yes.
So the Bridgewalk begins at noon, and there's actually the opportunity to walk across the Golden Gate Bridge if you choose to do that. And if you don't want to do that, if you have young children or you're someone who is maybe older and you don't want to do that long walk, there's going to be lots of activities at the park the whole time. So so there'll be kind of something for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Activities, lunch.
Activities, lunch. Yep. There's going to be, we're still very much in the planning stages, so I don't want to make any promises.
But there will be food.
Yes, there will be food.
And there will be beverages.
Yes.
And if people register ahead of time, there will be one of our stunningly beautiful T-shirts.
Just got the design today, and it is stunning.
Wow.
Yep, it is stunning. So,
wow.
Yep.
It was fun being in North Carolina on retreat the last few days. I would say 95% of the people there at some point had on one of the Africa T-shirts.
From the last 2 years.
The last 2 years. And it's so fun, and it's fun to think of those around in the world because at some point someone said, well, you know, I don't want to pay money and get a T-shirt. I'd rather just give the money to the project. And the point was made that when you wear the T-shirt and people ask you about the project, it's a wonderful introduction and opportunity to kind of enroll someone in your project. And
In fact, two of our monks were recently, when we had our recent retreat in Carmel, they were in the grocery store, and they said four or five people stopped them and asked them about the project based on seeing their T-shirt. So.
Yeah. Wow.
So come out and get a T-shirt, if nothing else.
Yeah, and it is. It's such a fun day. As Sherry said, it's always the most beautiful day of the year in San Francisco.
Yes.
It's her tradition.
Yeah. Last year it was, what, 80 degrees? 90 degrees?
Something like
perfect.
That.
Yeah.
And it's you can bring kids and pups and and all kinds of folks and have fun with us.
Wonderful. Gives me great pleasure to introduce Sister Marilyn Lacey, who's the Director of Refugee Services for Catholic Charities. Welcome, Marilyn.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here.
I'm enjoying being here.
Oh, good. Good.
Now we're going to put her on the spot.
Now we're going to put her on the spot.
Okay.
Sherry,
go. Yes, because my understanding is that you, well, I'm sure you work at many more things than this, but these are the two that I specifically know about and am fascinated by. One is your work with refugees, overseas, and then also finding foster homes for young refugees in this country.
Correct.
And the other is your support for the only girls' school in Sudan. Is that?
In southern Sudan.
In southern Sudan.
Huge territory, about this half the size of Western Europe.
And this is the only school for girls?
To my knowledge, yes. It was started by one of the bishops indigenous to that area, and he recognized that the entire population has been so traumatized by war, 21 years of uninterrupted war, that one key to the future would be the education of young women. And this is not, generally speaking, a high priority in the Sudanese cultures. So he's really thinking outside the box, and he has established this school in a little town called Naruse. And when I heard about it, I just knew right away that I had to get involved. I've known this bishop. His name is Parid Taban. He's a fearless advocate for peace, and on account of that, his own home has been bombed many times by the government that's waging civil war against the South. And his vision is for reconciliation among all the groups that have been at odds for so long. And he recognizes that to do that, you've got to start with the women and help them to heal the trauma they've experienced and to become educated and then to become educators and lay a real foundation for peace in the country. So when I heard about that school, I thought, I have to do something. Yes, I'm 10,000 miles away, but that doesn't matter. I have to do something. So we are planning a trip early in November, and I'm interested in bringing along with me on that trip a couple of good women. You know, like the Marines say, we're looking for a few good men. Well, I'm looking for a few good women who would like to come and see face-to-face the devastation of that war and the new hope that's possible with these women, and then who would pledge to become donors to help that school continue in the future. So,
because that's what it takes, isn't
absolutely.
It? It's that you can see it on TV, you can see it in magazines, but when you're right there and you're looking somebody in the eye and you see that shared humanity, it becomes very personal, and you just want to make a difference.
And I'm a sister of mercy, and it's that mercy to me is what the Greeks call splunknitsamai. It's a gut reaction. When you see need, you just have to do something, and you're empowered to do something once you open yourself to that. So I know that among your listeners there are so many good people, and people just need to be invited. That's what I think spirituality is about. It's inviting people to do the good that's possible.
That's in them.
Yes, it's already in
there. And so now, what are the ages of the students there? Is it a boarding school situation where they can come from all over the country?
Yes, exactly. It is a boarding school because the bishop specifically wanted to invite not just the young women from his own town, his area, but from all the different ethnic groups in southern Sudan. And so he has women from 24 different tribes, speaking 24 different languages, and coming together as a community of hope.
So he started with
sixth grade, and it's gone up now to 10th grade, and he just continues. It will go up through 12th in the next 2 years.
And so he is arranging right there what the country is going to eventually do, which is all come together with our different languages and traditions and learn
to
value one another. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And so you are one of the sources of funding for this. That's part of your commitment.
It is, and it's more than funding. It's advocacy, because I really believe that when you've seen something face-to-face and you allow yourself to be affected by that and to make some kind of response, that you'll give back whatever gifts you have within you. And for some people, that's a financial donation. That's terrific. It buys the books and it keeps the teachers paid and it makes the school possible. But for others, the gift would be to tell their neighbors what they saw. That strangers aren't necessarily enemies. And for others, it will be legislative advocacy. We are very interested in having congresspersons experience this, and we hope that some congressional aides will come on this trip with us in November. We have some strong interest. Because as the only superpower, I mean, what a responsibility is on our shoulders. And right now, it seems that all we are doing is alienating our neighbors around the world instead of building bridges. So I believe you start person to person and you build those bridges and you support and you advocate and you share what you've seen, and the world changes.
Now, is the bishop, has he sort of taken on personal responsibility for this? Many of the places where we've traveled, a child has to be able to pay school fees and buy a uniform and that sort of thing. And so that, of course, excludes.
Right. Those are generally government schools. In Sudan, the situation is quite different because the government, located in the north in Khartoum, the capital, is at war with the south and has been bombing the south and raiding the south, burning and pillaging for 21 years. We see in the newspapers lately in the west part of Sudan, in Darfur, the terrible tragedy that's in our living rooms on television at night, but the same kind of devastation has been occurring for 21 years in southern Sudan. And so when I went there 12 years ago in 1992, we drove for 11 hours into Sudan, north from Kenya, and we never saw a market or a telephone pole or another vehicle or even people, except for sentries, rebel sentries that would, you know, stop you along the road now and then. It's a completely devastated part of the world. So the bishop actually has his office in Nairobi. That's 1,000 miles away in another country because nothing functions inside Sudan. But he has had the foresight to construct a school there. There is a peace agreement that has almost been signed in the south, but it's been derailed now by this horrible uprising in Darfur and the genocide that's taking place there. But if peace does come, it's going to require a foundation to be laid. You can't just pick up after three generations of war and start to live peacefully. So he's ahead of the curve. He's building schools already and trying to put things in place. Of course, there's no electricity there, so he has generators that hook up to satellites. And I'm carrying over some laptops. We're going to get these young women onto the internet. Maybe they can listen to your show. Because these people will be the key to the new Sudan.
Yeah, you know, it's it sounds in some ways so similar, the situation, to the situation in Zimbabwe right now in terms of no resources. And so that's really amazing to have someone like the bishop who is there, who can find the resources, because that's such an issue with the work in Zimbabwe, is that there just aren't the resources. So even if you can find the funding in the United States to send over and assist, there just aren't even the resources to go in there. And it sounds like that's very much the same in southern Sudan. So amazing that you have in this one person such a big vision and the ability to bring the necessary resources there to actually create the school.
Well, I'm sure you're doing the same thing in your Africa project, but I know that people who have money are often a little hesitant to donate to something that's big and vague, and they wonder where the money's going and where's the accountability and what did it ever really get to the poor. And that is one of the tremendous advantages of, for example, working through the Zen Center or working through the people-to-people project that I'm involved in, is that we're carrying the money. We're handing it to the right people. We know what's going to make a difference there.
Yes, and that it has such that personal appeal that you're talking about, that it's really a two-way street, isn't it? That people can go there and assist because we have the resource to do that. And we're so transformed in that experience of being able to be there and experience that.
Well, that's absolutely it. I mean, I am not this generous, altruistic person. I have been so blessed by my 25 years of working with refugees.
Yeah.
And as you say, so transformed by that, that it's a gift for me to be involved in these ways. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so in that, in inviting people to come with you in November, it's sharing that gift, isn't it? It's extending an invitation to other people to experience that gift that you've experienced.
Exactly. And often when I go out and seek resources for our refugee resettlement work at Catholic Charities, or I go out to parishes or civic groups or whatever, and I'll be, you know, very bold in asking for what I need for the refugees. But I tell them, I'm not just asking you to give money. I'm wanting you to get involved because I want you to have the kind of joy that I've that I am experiencing.
Yeah.
And it comes from meeting the face of God in the stranger.
Yes.
I have this little fantasy as you're talking of people going over there and meeting these girls and making those kinds of personal connections and then going back for important occasions, you know, graduations and special things like that, and becoming family, even though there's so many thousands of miles apart.
It's so wonderful.
And it's a beautiful time to be doing this because you're talking about satellites and the laptops and the internet. This is what we found with our project in Zambia. We can actually now, you know, all you need is a little digital camera.
Right.
And there you are. I mean, you can see these kids doing all the things that they're doing. You can get to know them. You can communicate with them and follow their lives and their careers. And it's
exactly. It's and here we exciting. Sit in Silicon Valley, you know, the homeland of high tech. And I won't stand for having high tech used to, you know, design bombs that can drop on people. It's going to be used to connect people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we have a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this seems like a segue into the refugee work that you do, and maybe you could give us a little background on that before you let us know about this specific project with foster homes.
Thank you for asking, because it's my passion to talk about refugees. There are so many millions of refugees in the world. It can seem overwhelming. You sometimes see it on the news at night, and you think, oh, what can one person do? But I'm here to tell you that one person can do a lot. And although fewer than one half of 1% of refugees ever get selected to come to a first world country for resettlement.
Would you give me that number again? Just let it penetrate.
Fewer than one half of 1%. So that would be roughly one person out of every 200 in a refugee camp would ever get selected for a chance at a new life. Those who are lucky enough to be selected, it's primarily by the United States, Canada, Australia. They face tremendous challenges when they come. The American government is very generous in selecting folks to come over here, but not very generous in helping them after they arrive. Mm. It's the government's philosophy that this should be a private-public partnership, and you can interpret that to mean that the local folks should be generous and make it happen. And so we've accepted that challenge, and we are making it happen. And at Catholic Charities in San Jose, we welcome at the San Jose airport about 160 refugees per year. And we do everything from that first moment of welcome, which I consider one of the most important things that we do, because refugees have lived sometimes for 8, 10, 12, 14 years in places that do not welcome them. So we welcome them at the airport. We bring them to safe housing. We help them to acquire the skills that they're going to need to thrive here. Everything from English to computers to job preparation. We place them into jobs. We help them with their family issues. And it's kind of like adopting about 160 people a year because we are their family. And the we is, of course, not just me. It's a terrific team of folks, most of them former refugees, from the cultures of the folks we are welcoming, who understand what that journey has been, what the losses are, and what the what we call resettlement curve of, you know, the honeymoon period and then the sinking feeling of what you've lost, and then the slow rebuilding. So we do that work day in and day out. Probably once a week you'll see us at the San Jose airport, and it's always an amazing moment for us and also for the refugees themselves. They're usually the last one off the plane. They're so scared. Mm-hmm. They don't know what awaits them, and it's such a relief to them to find friendly faces who are there to support them through this transition.
And language right off the bat has to be quite a challenge in a lot of these cases.
It certainly would be if it were just me at the airport. But luckily, I have team members
who can speak with most of the cultures that you're serving.
Yes, it's amazing. And if we find a language group, for example, last month we started welcoming Burmese. I suppose I should say Myanmar, but I still think of the country as Burma. And we didn't have a Burmese speaker on staff. And lo and behold, volunteers just drop from the sky and are there to help us whenever we need it. So it's never been a problem.
Uh-huh, good.
So my basic work is this welcoming and supporting of refugees through the transition all the way 5, 6, 7 years until they become U.S. citizens and are really mainstreamed. And I, of course, have hundreds and hundreds of wonderful stories and great friendships that have resulted from this work. So I consider myself extremely blessed.
Uh-huh. Your family just grows by leaps and bounds.
Yes. And by cultures, which is so enriching.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I mean, growing up in suburban Bay Area, what I was missing until I got into refugee work.
Mm-hmm. Now, when a refugee comes over, is it primarily just an individual, or can they bring family, or do they have to establish here and then bring family over, or
all of the above?
Uh-huh.
The stories of their escape and then their eventual interviewing in the camps are all over the board. But many folks have been separated from family or have lost family members in the war or persecution or disruption that caused them to flee from their country in the first place. So it is very rare to get an intact family, but often we will get a widow or a widower with children. Hmm. Sometimes we'll get a nuclear family. Very often it will be a single individual who has managed to escape and who many years later will be able perhaps to sponsor over a few family members, mm-hmm. but not always.
That's one of the things that I've been very aware of with what's going on in Sudan, and of course, as you indicate, it's happening everywhere around the world. But when there will be an interview with somebody whose entire family has been destroyed, they're often a young person, and they're the last remaining member of an entire family.
Yeah. 2 months ago, just to give you one example, there are so many. We welcomed a young. Well, not so young, maybe 40-ish woman from Congo. Mm-hmm. And so I was chatting with her in my office, and I asked her, did she have a family? Oh, yes. Did she have a husband and children? Yes, she had a husband and 4 children. I said, well, where are they? She said, well, they're in Africa. I says, well, why didn't they come with you? Oh, well, sister, they're all dead. Hmm. And it just went through me like a knife. I mean, she had been speaking in the present tense. They're so much alive to her, but they were all killed instantly by a bomb, all at once. And then she just had to flee. And lived in the bush for years, scrambled to make ends meet, eventually ended up in a refugee camp, and by some miracle became part of that 0.5% chosen for resettlement.
Yes.
She'll be fluent in English in another couple of weeks, and she's already started her job search with the help of our team, so she's well on her way to making an what I consider an astounding adjustment.
Uh-huh. Yes. An adjustment from something that I would imagine most of us would see as the end of a life.
To tell you the truth, I think if what happens to them had happened to me, I would curl into the fetal position and not get out of bed, you know. And yet these people not only get up every day, they learn a new language, they learn a new culture, they find and hold jobs, and then they send most of their earnings back home to the refugee camp.
Oh, wow.
It's so heroic.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, we resettled 55 of what are called the Lost Boys of Sudan. And these are young men who lost their entire families by the kind of government action that's taking place in Darfur now. But this was in southern Sudan. And they trekked, I mean a biblical trek, 1,000 miles on foot as young children, 9, 10-year-olds, and then ended up in two different refugee camps for 12 years.
Wow.
They came to the U.S., and they were all wearing a kind of a flimsy jumpsuit, like jogging suit, that the U.S. government had given them as they boarded the plane. And so, of course, we take them out shopping and get them some basic clothes. The next morning, one of them came in and said to me, he had folded up his jogging suit, pressed it, and he said, "Sister, will you help me send this back to the camp? I have two pairs of pants now.
Wow.
My brother needs this one."
Wow. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber on KZSU Stanford. I'm your host, Michael Gray. We're having an amazing show today, and I'm excited to have with us today two special guests. Jen, who's the project coordinator for the African Vulnerable Children Project with Living Compassion, and Sister Marilyn Lacey, who's the director of refugee services at Catholic Charities in San Jose. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber on KZSU Stanford. We've been talking with Sister Marilyn Lacey today about refugees in general in Africa, in Sudan, bringing them back to the U.S. And we'd like to invite your calls today on this topic. Phone number here is 650-723-9010. If you'd like to ask Sister Marilyn a question about her work with refugees, please feel free to give us a call. Again, that number is 650-723-9010.
So I understand that another piece of your refugee work is actually finding foster homes for some of primarily young people?
Well, it's a brand new project because in the world's refugee camps, there are always what we call unaccompanied children. Minors who have been either separated from their families and the Red Cross has been unable to locate them because of the chaos of war, or whose families have been completely wiped out. And so they fend for themselves in the refugee camps. And occasionally, foreign governments like the United States will select some of these minors to come to the U.S. And they can't obviously be resettled the way we resettle adults by putting them immediately into an apartment. We need to find foster homes for them. You asked whether they're small children. Unfortunately, the answer is usually no, because of the length of time that people spend in refugee camps. It often takes many, many years, even after someone is selected, to be actually processed. And it's even worse since 9/11, right? All of the checks and double checks that people have to go through. So generally speaking, when a refugee arrives as an unaccompanied minor from a refugee camp, they're already a teenager, and oftentimes already 15, 16, 17 years old. So we're looking for folks who have room in their heart and in their house to take in a refugee minor, probably for only a year or a year and a half, because the way California foster care works, you need to emancipate by age 18 or 19 if you can graduate by your 19th birthday. Since most of these children have had their education interrupted, it's not likely they're going to matriculate from a U.S. high school. So we're probably looking at folks arriving and spending maybe a year with a foster family while they go to a U.S. high school and acclimate, and while we at Catholic Charities prepare them for living independently, give them job skills and language and cultural orientation. We've just started the program. And it is the only program of its kind in California, one of only 16 in the nation. So we're very excited that we were selected to put this program together. And we are in the wonderful position right now of inviting folks to come for an orientation if they feel they would like to know more about this program and become a foster parent or parents or a foster family to a newcomer.
When this young person finishes that year and a half, are there any provisions for going on to school, or are they they'll need to make their way after that unless the family gets very attached and wants to.
I hear that the families often get very attached and keep the youngster
getting very attached.
But actually, I can give you a good analogy, and that is that 2 years ago we welcomed the Lost Boys of Sudan, this group that I was mentioning before the break. And they were supposedly 18 or older at the time of arrival. But since they had been orphaned at such a young age, nobody really knew their age or their birth dates. So the American Immigration Service simply assigned an age to them and gave them all January 1st as their birth date. So every year on New Year's we have a big birthday party. But it sounds comical, but it had great consequences because someone who was assigned a birthday that made them 17 went into a foster care program. Someone who might be the same age but was randomly assigned a birthday that made him 18 came as an adult.
Oh, wow.
We got 55 of these adults in San Jose.
Wow.
I stand in amazement at what these young people have done with their lives. They are all living in apartments, grouped together, four or six in an apartment. They are all working. They are all almost all going to college.
Wow.
One of them, in the past 2 years, has not only graduated from De Anza, but is beginning Stanford this month.
Oh.
I mean, it takes your breath away.
I just got chills all over.
Yeah. And he was a 10th grader at the time of arrival because his education had been interrupted so much.
Yeah.
But he's so determined, and they help one another. And so it will be similar when these unaccompanied minors arrive, and let's say they're 16 or 17. And occasionally, who knows, you could get a 9 or 10-year-old, but the norm is a teenager. They will be expected to be independent by age 18, and I know it can be done.
Wow.
And our team at Catholic Charities will, of course, work with them extensively.
Yes.
And in hopes that they go on to college and work, and we help them balance all of that. We're used to doing it.
Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that in the same way we were looking at what a gift it is to bring people over to Sudan, let's say in this case, the same gift in welcoming someone into your home for that year and a half.
Absolutely.
What an amazing opportunity that could be for a family who's in the position to do that.
Absolutely. And it doesn't take finances to do it. We actually pay a stipend to the family that will cover the cost of their food and clothing. And it just takes a big, generous heart.
A big heart.
And, you know, space in your home so that you meet the standards of foster care. And we will provide plenty of support to the foster families and to the youth. We'll have monthly gatherings. We'll have all kinds of cultural support for them. Have tutors and mentors assigned to help them with their schoolwork. So it's not like the foster family is going to be alone in this project, but they will be the anchor and the hearth, providing the ongoing love that these children have missed.
Yes, yes. So is there a certain geographic area within which you're...
Well, because our office is in San Jose, we really are looking at the whole South Bay region as optimal. Mm-hmm. But actually, our first family to be come through the process is a family that lives here on campus. The father in the family is a professor here, and they have housing on campus, and they're going to be the first ones lined up to receive a minor into their home.
Wow.
The Bay Area, but with an emphasis on the South Bay Area, just for the convenience of getting together.
Uh-huh. Well, and you mentioned that this is one of 16 or 17 programs nationwide.
Right.
So if we do have listeners on other coasts or throughout the country, they could probably contact.
Absolutely. Let me give you some contact numbers.
Okay.
If anyone is interested in exploring the idea of becoming a foster family to a refugee child, please contact Colleen at 408-325-5159. Let me repeat that. Colleen at 408-325-5159. What did you ask me?
Just for folks around the country.
Oh, yes.
Is there a website or how might they get more information?
We would have the... addresses and contact numbers for the other 15 sites.
Oh, great.
Nate, the closest would be in Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
From where we are.
Yeah, because I don't want somebody out there
Absolutely.
Thinking, I would love to do this, but I don't live in the South Bay, so
right.
I'm excluded.
And we're willing, certainly, to work with the whole Bay Area. Mm-hmm. But our hope is, and our expectation is that there would be enough families in the South Bay. Certainly there are folks with resources and large homes that
Sure. You have the answer to the empty nest syndrome.
I do.
This is very good. I was just in a conversation with somebody about that in the last couple of days. And this, because they were, you know, looking at, my gosh, what are we going to do with ourselves
and
now that
actually,
the kids are gone?
The empty nesters make marvelous foster parents because they've been through those teenage years.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. And they roll with it. You know,
yes.
They know.
Yeah.
The ups and
They're
downs.
They're in gear.
They're in gear. Yes, we would welcome that. And actually, I hope people respond so that they can experience some of the joy that mm-hmm. I have known in this ministry. It's hard to describe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me give out our phone number one more time in case people want to call in and ask questions about the refugee work in Sister Marilyn. The phone number is 650-723-9010. Again, that's 650-723-9010. We'd love to hear from you today.
So, Sister Marilyn, you've talked a little bit about the resourcefulness of the folks who come here and do this, who become, quite successful in the face of the circumstances that they're in. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how that happens. It sounds like, as you say, the U.S. government does not, you know, helps them to get over here, but then does not kind of continue that support.
An adult refugee who comes here is eligible for refugee assistance and health care for the first 8 months that they're in the country.
Wow.
At the princely sum of $400 a month.
Whoa.
Wow.
Probably the most important piece of that is the health care that is provided because so many of them have either been tortured or neglected in the area of health care for so many years. We take the view that with lots of community help, lots of volunteers, we can transform a refugee's life in 6 months. It's
wow.
like that old name that tune. I can do this in 6 months.
Wow.
And for the most part, that is about what it takes and how it works. There are, of course, refugees who have been wounded very deeply, particularly those who are survivors of torture.
Sure.
And for them, the path is much longer.
Mm.
The resiliency is just not there, and the healing takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But if a refugee...
As it would for any of us, yes. just to
underline absolutely.
That. Absolutely. I mean, if something like that happened to us in our own country,
yes.
It would take...
You know, I remember the 1989 earthquake. Now, I'm a Californian. I've been through earthquakes all my life. But that one, it scared me. And for about a week afterward, I think I slept with my shoes on because I wanted to be ready to run, you know. Well, that was one quake, which didn't even knock my house down. The refugees, when they hear an airplane fly by, they flinch. They dodge for cover because they equate that with bombs.
Sure.
Yeah.
One fellow from Iraq said to me, "Sister, I love San Jose. I know I'm safe here, but I can't help it. Every time there's a knock on my front door, I run and hide in my bedroom.
Wow.
And I know with my head that it's a neighbor bringing some food.
Yeah.
But my body carries the scars." And this was a man who had been in one of Saddam's jails for some time and suffered torture there. So each person carries his or her own burdens, and they help one another in the process of starting over.
6 months. That's
it's an Olympic event.
Yes. Wow. And of course, a huge part of it has to be that what you're really setting them up in is this network of support.
Yes.
So that they truly become part of a community that's going to sustain them.
Of course, there isn't any other way. Mm-hmm. And this crazy idea that we Americans have that individualism is the way to go is so wrong. Community and the support and the kindness of strangers, that's what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are in contact with the refugees for years. I mean, it's really wonderful. On their days off from work, many of them work odd shifts, and on their day off, they come back to Catholic Charities.
That's great.
I know, just one of them will come back, appear in my doorway, and he'll just say, "I come to greet you." And I was like, it's like an angel, it's a biblical apparition or something. But they just—it's home for them.
Yeah. Sure,
it's the base from which they're able to to venture out. And we have some terrific staff. We have a job developer who's been with us about 16 years. He has refugees that he placed into jobs 10 years ago, now making triple what he makes. And I say, "Aren't you ever tempted to go off and do that?" And he shakes his head, "No, sister, my joy is seeing them succeed."
Yes. Yeah.
And how right he is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I just wish he could, in that idealistic sort of way, I wish he could do that and still make a good living. But sadly, it's often seen as either or. So I don't know that much about refugee camps, sadly. We just got an email last month, I guess it is now. We were in Zambia where we saw the house that we purchased for the orphans, and then we got an email saying they had arrived. And in the note, it was acknowledged that these children had never flushed a toilet. They'd never turned a light switch.
Mm.
They'd never slept in a bed. They'd never, and it was just so fun to think about. You know, it must be like Disney World, especially because they're coming into a family. It's that same kind of support.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if some of these folks are coming from those kinds of
very
primitive conditions.
We operate three houses in San Jose, which we call refugee transition houses, and we have a manager in each house because they need to learn how to use our appliances, what our standards of hygiene are, how to clean a kitchen, all those kinds of things. So we do that, but I've often, you know, wondered what impresses the refugees when they first come. So, well, one of these Sudanese young men, he was 18 at the time of arrival, though I suspect he was about 16, but his paperwork said 18, so he got a job right away. And I remember asking him, I said, "Well, Gabriel, what's your impression of San Jose? You know, what really amazed you about America?" And I was sure he would say, "Oh, the traffic, the tall buildings, the computers." I mean, because he came from 12 years in a dusty refugee camp in the middle of the desert in northern Kenya, where there is nothing but a few goats and a lot of camel spiders. I've been there.
That's kind of a daunting combination of words, isn't it?
Large.
So I asked him, I said, what amazed you the most? And without blinking, he said to me, "Oh," he said, "you know what amazed me the most? Never in my life could I have imagined that anyone would welcome me like this."
Wow.
Mm.
Wow. Wow.
So we learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm.
What really matters.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Wow.
So I wonder what, you know, as people are listening and I project being moved at the work you're doing, if there's how people could be involved, how people, you know, is there a role for volunteers in the...
Absolutely. We could not do this work without volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And we use all kinds of volunteers, from high school students to retired folks, because there's so much that needs doing, everyone can contribute whatever gifts they have, either as a tutor or as a mentor, or as a friend, or as someone who can support them in the work site, or someone who can take them shopping. I mean, supermarkets are so baffling.
Yes.
You can't tell what the food is. It's all wrapped up. You can't smell it. I mean, you know. So there's so much to be done. And anyone that would be interested either in contributing financially or exploring the idea of becoming a foster family or just... saying I could give an hour or two a week as a volunteer or a month, whatever, should call me at Catholic Charities, 408-325-5155. Let me repeat it, 408-325-5155. You can also get me by email, Lacey, that's L-A-C-E-Y, at ccsj.org, Catholic Charities San Jose.
And what a chance, in a way, to get to see your own life again, sort of, because I had this image, as you were saying, you know, walking in the grocery store. I mean, we walk in the grocery store, we don't even think of it. You know, we don't,
right.
We just don't even realize what we have, what's around us, what's...
And may I?
Yeah.
For myself, often with an attitude of irritation, that I have
exactly.
to take time out of my busy life
to go and buy
get
food.
Those groceries.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
That's a perspective.
Yes. And to be a volunteer who I imagine is trained because, you know, to get that orientation of, okay, you're going to be walking in the grocery store with someone who's never been in a big grocery store like this. So here are some of the things. So we get to see our lives through these through new eyes, essentially. Having to kind of see what's...
You are so right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we need to realize that simple things like walking through a grocery store that is stacked to the ceiling with food can also trigger a kind of survivor's guilt in the refugees.
Mm-hmm.
The camp that I was referring to in Africa where the Sudanese spent 12 years, they received one meal a day. The same thing every day for 12 years.
Yep. Mm.
Ground up maize.
Mm-hmm.
They walk into a grocery store and see so much food, they start to question,
yes.
why do I have this? And my brothers back there don't have
right.
anything.
Yep.
And so they just need a lot of support on a lot of fronts.
Yes.
Mm. Well, we're getting near the end of the hour here. You've been listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber on KZSU Stanford. Had two special guests today. Jen, who's the project coordinator for the African Vulnerable Children Project for Living Compassion. Sister Marilyn Lacey, who's the director of Refugee Services at Catholic Charities of San Jose. What an amazing show.
Yeah.
I really want to thank you for this chance to be with you.
Oh, thank you for joining us. It's beyond inspiring.
It's been great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
If you want to contact us when we're off the air, you can reach us at openair@kzsu.org. You can also listen to archives of Open Air at livingcompassion.org. I'd like to thank Jay and Andy and all of our listeners for joining us today.
So next week we'll have to give Andy a little more to do.
A little more work.
A little more work. He's,
yes.
He's been kind of... able to rest in there.
Uh-huh. Slacking, probably.
Slacking off, yeah. He's kind of laying around back there. So next week we'll get lots of callers and get him hopping.
Yes. Great. Please join us next week. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.